in order to exist. He doesn't need anything else in order to have knowledge, in order to know, in order to have power, in order to have life, in order to create. So it's necessary to reject this idea and to come to a more profound and precise explanation of the relationship between God's essence and his attributes. It's ironic that many years before this theory appeared, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in one of his sermons, which has been related in the book Nahjul Balagha, referred to this idea and rejected it. In the first sermon of the Nahjul Balagha, Imam Ali alayhi salam says the following: فَمَنْ وَصَفَهُ سُبْحَانَهُ فَقَدْ قَرَنَهُ وَمَنْ قَرَنَهُ فَقَدْ صَنَّهُ وَمَنْ صَنَّهُ فَقَدْ جَزَّهُ وَمَنْ جَزَّهُ فَقَدْ جَهِلَهُ. Imam Ali alayhi salam's sermon says that if somebody ascribes attributes to God which are additional to his essence, it means that in reality he has paired God with another being besides him. In other words, this attribute, like for example, knowledge or power. If somebody does so, it implies that there's a multiplicity in him. It would mean that he's composed of parts, he's not simple in nature, and in essence, this would mean that this person hasn't really understood what God is. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the problem of the relationship between God's essence and his attributes. Inshallah, in our forthcoming discussions, we will examine this more in detail. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our listeners out there, assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is IRIB English Radio, and the program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri, and we have in the studio with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Brother Miqdad, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So we've been talking for the last two episodes about taqwa and how we can teach our 8-year-olds about taqwa. The question was actually, the original question that we were following reads, we have heard a lot about taqwa and its importance in Islam. I wanted to ask about how I can teach my 8-year-old daughter about taqwa. So, first of all, we said that there are various levels to taqwa, and generally speaking, taqwa means to remain aware of God and His expectations. We then explained that at this age that we're talking about, children are mostly moved by their habits, the things that they are used to. And so, first of all, we should get them into the habits of being honest and any other positive trait that we want them to have. And then you said that this is the age where children start creating role models for themselves. And it's very important to give them the right role model, which is the Ahlul Bayt. And for you listeners out there, we have a whole few episodes about this role model. It's very important, and we've studied this issue very deeply in several episodes. You might want to download that from our website. And one key issue that you said in the last episodes is that taqwa isn't something that you teach in theory. It's something that you learn by practice. Let's talk a little bit more about the importance of the right role model for our children for learning about taqwa.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So let me start the show with this beautiful hadith. So this is hadith number 226 in our book. So the Messenger of Allah is reported to have said that raise your children, adibu awladakum ala thalathi khasal. Raise your children to have three features or three traits or three characteristics. And the Prophet names these three. It says, حُبُّ نَبِيِّكُمْ, love for your Prophet, وَحُبِّ أَهْلِ بَيْتِ, and love for his Ahlul Bayt, وَعَلَى قِرَاءَةِ الْقُرْآنِ, and upon the recitation of the Holy Qur'an. So the first two is very much about love of the Prophet and love of the Ahlul Bayt. And this is, when we talk about love, we're talking about role model. If you remember when we talk about role model, that the principal feature in a role model is this love, this attachment, this emotional link between the two individuals. And once we have the love of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, because they're the most perfect in taqwa, because they're the ones who have reached the highest level of taqwa, we want to be like them, we want to adopt. And if a child has this motivation or this love for the Ahlul Bayt, then what happens is that they also want to have the similar traits. One of them includes taqwa. So once we've got the good habits, once we have this role model, then what happens is that a child is now, a child's attractions and a child's likes and dislikes are based upon this role model, based upon what they've learned from the Ahlul Bayt. And that leads them towards wanting to know more. Okay, and this is very, very crucial. And this is why you see that children, when they reach the age just around 11, 12, 13, if they've gone through this path, then they want to learn more. They've got loads of questions. They're full of questions. Tell me about God. Tell me what kind of God this is. Tell me about the Prophet. Why is the Prophet infallible? Tell me about Karbala. They've got 1.5 million questions, right, about different things. They're thirsty to learn more. And this is where we have to ensure that we do the right steps.
This is where the teaching, the theories of taqwa begins. It kicks in. All right, let's take a break, and we will be back for further discussion after the break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic upbringing. We're talking about how to teach our 8-year-old children about taqwa. And up to now, we've said that first we have to get them into the habit of having and acquiring positive traits. Then we have to allow them to have or guide them to have the right role models, which are the Ahlul Bayt. And I'm just thinking with myself, if I want to teach my child about honesty, and I want to tell them that honesty is good, My child is probably not going to understand the notion of the hereafter and then waiting for the hereafter for reward. And when he goes to school and there's an exam and he doesn't cheat because of honesty, and then the result comes out that his friends who did cheat got an excellent grade, and he who didn't cheat, he got a very low grade. That this caused shame for him in the class. I'm probably not going to be able to convince him if I tell him that after you die, there are going to be rewards for you in the hereafter. How do you deal with that?
I don't think we should talk about the hereafter from such a young age and the reward and the punishment of the hereafter. Honesty is kind of a fitri trait, right?
Innate trait.
Innate trait. Children understand the value of honesty, and they would count it as positive. It's just because the scenario over here was that honesty and the dishonesty of others led them to reach a goal that this child couldn't. But if you make them, if you really explain to the child that, you know what, you know inside you that they did a bad thing to reach there. And do you think it's good to reach there with a bad way, on a bad path? Or is it better that you didn't get it, but at least you were honest? I think, without explaining anything, I think most children, if they go back to themselves, they'll be like, yeah, you're right. It's better if I was honest, even though I didn't get it. Assume they don't, I think you can give other examples of places where honesty is much more rewarded, even if it's worldly examples. So things like trust, right? If you're honest, people trust you, right? Number one, children understand that. They want to be trusted by people, right? So I want to give you, I don't know, my car keys, for example, that you can hold on to my car keys for some time, depending how old it is. Or I want to give you my bank card, for example, or some money to put in your pocket, right? But would I trust you if you're dishonest? No, you wouldn't, right? And again, trust and being able to be trusted upon is something that is very innate. Children like that. The other thing that you can explain to them, for example, is that you yourself like to be said the truth to, right? None of us like to be cheated. Imagine if you were selling something or you were buying something and somebody gave you something really bad and lied about it. Would you appreciate it? Children will obviously say no, right? So through these examples, there's even worldly benefits. They can learn about these simple akhlaqi and ethical moral traits, basically. You don't have to bring about the hereafter at this level, because this is where you just want to get them to, number one, get the good habits, get the right habits ingrained. And secondly, you want to direct them towards the Ahlul Bayt, basically. The Ahlul Bayt were honest. The Ahlul Bayt were always saying the truth. These two are very important right now at this stage. It's very much later on that you talk about the hereafter and the effects and the positive and negative consequences that can happen in the hereafter.
I'm just going to throw in another question here. And if the answer is the same as the answer that you just gave me, just tell me. Otherwise, we'll have to put it for after the break. This would be a fantastic response for children who are being raised in a normal community. But our show isn't just for them. There are families out there who'd like to raise a perfect child, but they don't have the luck to live in a good community. They might be living in a community where there are always demonstrations of the opposite, where being dishonest, being aggressive, being rude is how you get your way through. And quite to the contrary, being honest, being peaceful, brings more trouble than it brings good. For the parent out there who is living in that situation against their own will, would you say that this same method would be useful? If there's a long response, we can put this for after the break.
Yeah, definitely. There is. The methodology is pretty much the same. You just have to add a few factors that I'll mention just after the break.
Okay, so then let's take a break with that question, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about how to teach taqwa to our children who are 8 years old. And so one thing that we're talking about is the importance of habits. Just before the break, we're talking about how if a good habit like honesty turns out to have some negative repercussions, how we have to explain to our children that it's better to be a good person and we don't have to make it related to the afterlife because they won't understand anyway. And before the break, I asked, what about children who live in a community which is culturally poor, and the children, when going outside, constantly is seeing signs that honesty, peacefulness is actually too expensive, and it's aggressiveness, rudeness, and it's dishonesty which actually solves their problems in practice. How is the parent out there who is unlucky to be in that situation and is listening to us, how are they going to teach their children that it's still better to be honest, even in that situation?
In most of these situations, there are certain things that prevail. One of them is strength, right? A lot of the things that are related to dishonesty and cheating and this kind of thing is because of strength, right? It's because I want to get to a point of strength, of authority, of position, of wealth. And the path that leads me to this, that I want to take, is dishonesty, is cheating, is violence, right? So children that are growing up in these kind of situations where obviously they can't escape it, the key for parents is to teach the children how to gain strength, right? And self-confidence, basically. And to be strong inside and outside as well, both, right? So physically strong, but also inside as well, very, very confident. And that doesn't mean that you teach them to be strong and to be confident by the wrong ways, right? Because at the end of the day, what's important out there is that strength, right? And if you think about it, you realize that if you send a child out there that's a very strong child, a very confident child, a child that sticks with his principles and would die for his principles, right? But at the same time, it's a child that's very honest, right? Ready to sacrifice for his honesty. A child that doesn't cheat, that doesn't swear, right? But nobody messes around with him, right? Do you think he'll survive in that situation? I think he would, right? So the key wasn't to teach dishonesty or to encourage the negative traits. The key is to get them to the same goal that society might have, which is strength, for example.
Authority.
And having said all of that, even that in that kind of place, for example, things like standing by your principles is something that's recognized. So if you come up as saying that my principle is not to lie, and if you stand by it, then you'll be respected.
So, but the first step there is for the parents to be ready to stand by all the hardships that come with that.
Definitely, that's very difficult to understand.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we are out of our time, but you can always download an archive of this episode and our previous episodes from our website. Simply search www.parstoday.com. That's www.parstoday.com and find the Call of Islam page. You'll find us there as well. And you can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Africa Today.
Western powers are increasing their military operations, especially secret ones in Africa. The former colonial powers have established more military bases in the continent. However, masses in some African countries have come out to oppose the presence of Western military forces, especially U.S. forces, in their countries.
We have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence, what it has attracted. It has attracted terrorism. It has attracted destabilization.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya.
And I am Sheila Nelima. Welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on military operations in Africa by Western powers, especially the U.S., and how they are destabilizing the continent.
In the second part of our program, we are discussing how the United States is forcing African countries to establish diplomatic ties with the Israeli regime and support its political and commercial interests.
We also have our weekly update of news and events from all parts of Africa. So stay tuned till the end.
Secret operations in Africa. There are several reports about secret military missions in Africa by the Western powers. At least 13 foreign powers have a substantial military presence on the continent. The U.S. and France are at the forefront of conducting both covert and overt military operations on African soil.
The pretext of Western military presence in Africa is combating terrorism. However, the presence of these foreign forces has led to an upsurge of deadly terrorist attacks across the continent.
Civilians have also borne the brunt of some of the secret military operations. This has especially been the case in Somalia, where U.S. carries out regular drone strikes.
For more on Western military presence in Africa, we contacted Daniel Lazar, a New York-based author and journalist. Thanks a lot for joining us, Mr. Lazar. What is the nature of the objectives that the world powers seek in Africa by their military presence?
Well, it's not quite clear what the goal is here. Essentially, the U.S.-African role was expanded in response to the war on terrorism. So the years 2007-2008 saw a major expansion. But the question is what the goal is. I suppose the goal is to contain terrorism. But, of course, it also involves expanding U.S. military influence, selling U.S. Weapons, establishing close relations with military leaders in Africa, and generally just sort of increasing the U.S. role in that part of the world.
Thanks for that, Mr. Daniel Lazar, author and journalist, and stay tuned for more.
The dramatic increase in Western military activities in Africa is a sad reminder of the brutal colonization. However, masses in some countries have come out to openly reject Western military presence. In 2018, thousands of Ghanaians protested in the country's capital, Accra, against plans to build a United States military base in the country. This was a rare public display of opposition to the growing Western military presence in West Africa.
This is an agreement which clearly is not in our national interest. If you allow for a permanent U.S. military presence in our country, we have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence, what it has attracted. It has attracted terrorism, it has attracted destabilization, and we don't want Ghana to be destabilized. We also say that this agreement is lopsided, it's one-sided, there's nothing in it for Ghana apart from the dangers.
Following the protests, the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, affirmed in no uncertain terms that Ghana has not offered a military base to the U.S.
So let me state with the clearest affirmation that Ghana has not offered a military base and will not offer a military base to the United States of America.
Mr. Lazar, how do you think the Western military presence in Africa endangers the socio-political situation and the everyday livelihood of people of the continent in the long run?
Well, they have a definite impact in terms of militarizing those societies, and that militarization takes place across a broad number of fronts. First of all, in terms of what's called terrorism, what we know as terrorism, military intervention often drives it to new heights. Rather than beating it back, it actually exacerbates it, makes it worse. I mean, the classic example is Libya, which is a country that was stable to a degree before the U.S. Intervened in 2011 and has since turned into a major stronghold for al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other such groups. The same thing is happening in Somalia, where the al-Shabaab seems to be increasing its influence, and al-Shabaab is extending its influence into neighboring Kenya as well.
Mr. Lazar there has mentioned Libya, which plunged into chaos in 2011 when a popular uprising was halted by a US-led NATO military intervention. Now, during a protest in Tripoli last December, the demonstrators were unanimous that foreign military intervention is the source of chaos in their country.
The West's military operations in Africa are allegedly aimed at battling terrorism. Have they been effective or just preparing the ground for more terrorists?
No, they have definitely backfired. There's no question that they've led to more terrorism. I mean, these interventions, these military activities are very disruptive. They're very violent, obviously. They kill local people, and therefore they spread anger and resentment wherever they take place. Anger and resentment against the U.S., of course, and that redounds to the benefit of terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab or ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So therefore, these military operations usually have a negative effect in the sense that they tend to exacerbate the problem they're supposedly combating.
Western powers are increasingly adopting a military approach in their ties with Africa to ostensibly combat terrorism. However, the ultimate objective is to plunder natural resources, including oil and minerals such as uranium, and counter China's influence in the continent. The militarization of relations between Western powers, especially the U.S. and African governments, has eroded good governance. Let's take a listen.
You have an increasing number of what they call small footprint bases throughout Africa. And so the U.S., rather than deploying large numbers of troops, is starting to create outposts where they can fly drones and other essentially robotic tools of war, and then also partnering up with unsavory militias or human rights abusing governments.
Have Western military operations in Africa negatively impacted on politics and governance in Africa?
Well, it does so by essentially militarizing those societies. And when you militarize those societies, you create bigger military establishments, bigger militaries, bigger armies. More of the national revenue goes to the purchase of advanced weaponry from the U.S., so therefore less money is spent on social services, for example, or education or healthcare. But it also encourages the military to take a more prominent political role. So therefore, the military becomes the new center of power. And when that happens, the politics become more authoritarian, more militaristic, and less democratic. So therefore, you wind up strengthening all these tendencies, which essentially are negative in terms of the broad population of those countries, which do not need authoritarian politics.
Western military presence in Africa, whether it is covert or overt, leads to increased violence and instability throughout the continent. Sustainable peace and stability is achievable in Africa by finding African solutions to African problems.
And now we're going to present you with a package of news and events from Africa. What do you have to talk for us, Sheila?
Thank you, Henia. This week it's about bees versus elephants, an annual festival, but fast. The Republic of Angola committed to the African Convention on Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. The document was delivered to the African Union and requires all parties to take all measures for the protection, conservation, and sustainable use of nature. This becomes one of the several official ratifications adhered to by the Angolan state in 2020 alone. Others include treaties on cybersecurity, justice, and human rights. Now, Ethiopia has suspended its plan to privatize its national carrier. The decision was supported by the fact that the airlines appear to be doing well, being the continent's most successful carrier. The government stated that maintaining its capacity is more beneficial to the economy. Now, on to a sad reality. Borrow money to buy food. The situation in Nigeria. This is due to food inflation that has risen to over 16% during a period of months. The inflation is being blamed on the COVID-19 pandemic and the effect of shutting its borders with Benin and other West African states. Now, in other news, the South African government has committed to providing over $60 billion for the creation of job opportunities and infrastructure investments over the next 4 years. The commitment is part of the Reconstruction and Recovery Plan aimed at reviving the economy following the COVID-19 outbreak. The government also adopted a new generation project that enables a more stable energy infrastructure, with over 50% being sourced from renewable energy. Now, Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique has resorted into a beehive project to keep its elephants in. The project is to curb the conflict that has been caused by elephants crossing over into people's farms and destroying villages while looking for a snack. The beehive project is to improve conservation efforts by avoiding human retaliation. Now, the Visa for Music Festival took place in Morocco despite the pandemic. The annual program is a professional music market showcasing artists from the Middle East and Africa. Held in Rabat, Morocco, the festival includes conferences, training, and workshops. That's all we had for you this week. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Africa.
The United States is now acting on behalf of the Israeli regime by pressurizing African countries to establish diplomatic and commercial ties with the regime. Kenya and Sudan are the latest victims of this U.S. policy.
The U.S. wants Kenya to support Israel's political and commercial interests or forget a free trade deal with Washington. According to the East African, a weekly newspaper published in Nairobi, the U.S. has indicated that the deal with Kenya should discourage politically motivated actions to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel.
The United States is also pressing Sudan to establish diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. Washington recently removed Sudan from a U.S. list of states that allegedly sponsor terrorism. This is said to be part of a deal that will set the stage for Sudan to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
Now, for an incisive analysis on this issue, we contacted Firoz Manji, an activist and professor of African studies at Carleton University in Canada. Thanks a lot, Professor Manji, for your time. Why is the U.S. forcing African countries to have ties with Israel for sanctions to be lifted or trade agreements to be signed?
The U.S. is insistent. Its policy is today to make sure that following Saudi Arabia, following the other Middle Eastern countries seeking to recognize Israel and to create those economic relations. It's a way of ensuring that the Zionist position is given strength from a complicit African regimes. And of course, our regimes are effectively they are beholden to the U.S. And so we can expect that most of them will do the U.S.'s bidding.
Activist and professor of African studies at Carleton University, Canada.
The move by the U.S. to include a third party, the Israeli regime, in trade talks with Kenya has seen lobby groups in Nairobi warn that the agreement could be too risky for Kenya. Leonard Wanyama, the co-coordinator of the East African Tax and Governance Network, is concerned that U.S. demands might compel Kenya to alter its pragmatic foreign policy.
We could say that this would complicate Kenya's own foreign policy, because it would mean that the country has to rewrite its own principles that it has been using in place since as far back as independence, in terms of having a pragmatic foreign policy.
Professor Manji, do you think the Kenyan government will submit to U.S. demands and abandon the African Union position on Palestine?
I think that's a strong possibility. I think the president Kenyatta has visited Israel. We know that there's a close relationship between Kenya and Israel, even if it's formally not acknowledged. But a lot will depend on whether citizens in Kenya will protest at this and make sufficient noise about this to prevent it happening. There is a very dynamic and strong anti-Zionist movement in Kenya, and so much will depend on civil society's ability to protest and make sure that there is not a breach in that relationship.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Sudan last August to push for a normalization deal with the Israeli regime. In February, Israeli regime's premier held secret talks with Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the head of Sudan's ruling transitional council in Uganda.
The talks triggered protests in Khartoum, while many political and religious leaders condemned the meeting.
هذا الخبر لو ثبت بأن الفريق الأول عبد الفتاح البرهان قد قابل الصهيوني بنيامين نتنياهو واتفق معه على التطبيع هذه خيانة لله ورسوله وقد فعل هذا الأمر عن غير مشورة من الشعب ولا عن غير رضا منه.
The Israeli regime is frantically trying to break its isolation by using U.S. influence. This pariah regime is bent on compelling African countries to abandon their historical support for Palestinian liberation. Why is the Israeli regime desperate on having ties with African countries and is intent on using unorthodox means to achieve this objective?
I think the battle is to legitimize the settler state, to legitimize the practice of anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab racism as a norm, and to normalize that the occupation of Palestine and the subjugation of its people is something that is central to that agenda. But to be able to get away with it, they need to have sufficient consensus internationally, at least to be seen to be complicit and in recognizing the illegal occupation of large territories of Palestine.
Despite all its efforts, the Israeli regime has seen setbacks in its policy to extend its influence in Africa. Last year, South Africa downgraded its embassy to Israel. Opposition leader Julius Malema of the EFF party has taken a tougher anti-Israeli stance by calling on the country's government and the business community at large to cut all ties with Israel.
We are saying to South Africa, remove our embassy in Israel and then remove this one from South African soil.
What should African countries do to resist U.S. bullying and pressure regarding Israel?
Well, I mean, I think most, not all, but most of our governments are beholden to the U.S. And I can't see them offering any real resistance. However, there are amongst the population, I think there are significant movements and civil societies who could be organizing to put pressure on their governments to resist that pressure, and that has been a sort of constant battle.
Professor Manji there believes that it is only people's power and resistance that can stop U.S. and Israeli imperialism in Africa.
Numerous Sudanese political parties also lined up to declare their outright rejection of the normalization agreement between their country and the Israeli regime, stressing they're going to form a front to oppose the move. Sudan's National Umma Party, NUP, has rejected any normalization with the Israeli regime. The NUP's leader, Sadr al-Mahdi, said the transitional government, which is to remain in office until elections in 2022, has no mandate to make decisions on such controversial issues. According to Sudan's acting foreign minister, Omar Gamarettin, however, the accord will depend on approval from its yet-to-be-formed legislative council. The agreement sparked outrage among the public in Sudan, where pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Many Sudanese people have come out openly to speak against the deal.
That brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today, which focused on Western military presence in Africa.
And how the U.S. is pushing the Israeli agenda in Africa. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, it's goodbye for now and God bless.
In the limelight.
Facing possible defeat in the U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump has again floated the idea of a rigged election, just days after his refusal to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, raising concerns that he might refuse to leave office, even if he loses the November vote. President Donald Trump has repeatedly cast doubt on mail voting, claiming that mail-in ballots lead to mass voter fraud. However, due to the coronavirus pandemic, millions of Americans prefer not to vote in person. At least in 9 states, every registered voter will automatically be mailed an application to request an absentee ballot. Experts believe that by escalating his ongoing attack on mail-in ballots, Donald Trump was ceding the ground to contest the election as rigged or fraudulent in the event of losing the election and push the country into chaos. The president also sent shockwaves across the United States recently when he refused to commit to leave office peacefully if he loses this November's election. We're prepared for you an article written by Muhammad Mazhari entitled A Bizarre Election, American Democracy at Dead End. Please stay with us for more. U.S. presidential election will be on the line this November, but what about the American democracy? President Donald Trump's wrong policies and statements not only have dangerously made America's democratic health hang in the balance, but also the country's integrity as a whole. Many consider Donald Trump as a very example of a politician who values and respects no moral principles, and is so narcissistic and power-hungry that it is hard for him to imagine leaving the White House. From such a perspective, it seems that the upcoming election may prove more critical and controversial than previous ones. According to The Guardian, when asked during a press briefing at the White House on 23rd of September, Donald Trump replied, "We're going to have to see what happens, you know that. I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster." Donald Trump refused to commit when asked again, "Get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly, there will be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it, and you know who knows it better than anybody else. The Democrats know it better than anyone else. Critics say Trump wants to maintain his power and will use every means to stay in the White House, even if it leads to a deep split in the country or even a civil war. U.S. President Donald Trump said at the Republican National Convention on 24th of August, "The only way they can take this election away from us is if it is a rigged election." Unless he wins a bona fide victory in the Electoral College, Donald Trump looks determined to refuse to concede defeat, and his mere denial of defeat may have cascading repercussions. Facing possible defeat in the U.S. presidential election, President Donald Trump has once again floated the idea of a rigged election, just days after his refusal to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, raising concerns that he might refuse to leave office even if he loses this November's vote. Donald Trump tweeted, "Rigged election," on Monday, 28th of September, along with a video purportedly showing a man caught on camera whilst paying cash for ballot exchange. The video shows a man buying a registration form for an absentee ballot for a voter, giving him pocket money of $200 and expecting to collect his ballot when the voter receives it. The man is heard saying, "Okay, when I fill it out, I'll bring it to you." Donald Trump has repeatedly cast doubt on mail-in voting, claiming that mail-in ballots lead to mass voter fraud. However, due to the coronavirus pandemic, millions of Americans prefer not to vote in person. At least in 9 states, every registered voter will automatically be mailed an application to request an absentee ballot. Experts believe that by escalating his ongoing attack on mail-in ballots, Donald Trump was ceding the ground to contest the election as rigged or fraudulent in the event of losing the election and push the country into chaos. His controversial remarks have drawn reactions from both Democrats and his own party members, with Republican Senator Mitt Romney saying in a tweet that a peaceful transition of power is fundamental to democracy. A Democratic lawmaker from California, Adam Schiff, described Trump's comments as an effort by the president to discredit the votes of millions of Americans, to stack the Supreme Court, to disenfranchise millions, and perpetuate himself in office by enlisting foreign assistance. Citing mail-in ballots, Donald Trump tweeted recently that this year's election may never be accurately determined. In another tweet, Donald Trump said, "Rigged election in waiting." In such a situation, it is natural for the American people to be in a panic about the future of their country because, in case of a civil war, all eyes will be on the U.S. Army. That is why top generals in the Pentagon have expressed their concerns about Trump's ordering active duty military into the streets of American cities to quell protests after the presidential election. Pentagon General Mark Milley of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in remarks released last month, made clear that the U.S. military is determined not to play a role in resolving the dispute over election results. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said in written answers to questions from House lawmakers released last month, General Milley said, "I believe deeply in the principle of an apolitical U.S. military," adding, "In the event of a dispute over some aspect of the election, by law, U.S. courts and the U.S. Congress are required to resolve any disputes, not the U.S. military. I foresee no role for the U.S. armed forces in this process." On 11th of August, John Nagle and Paul Yingling, both retired U.S. Army officers and Iraq War veterans, published an open letter to General Milley on the website Defense One. They wrote, "In a few months' time, you may have to choose between defying a lawless president or betraying your constitutional oath," adding, "If Donald Trump refuses to leave office at the expiration of his constitutional term, the United States military must remove him by force, and you must give that order." Meanwhile, Donald Trump gave officials no solace when he refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, no matter who wins the election. On Thursday, 24th of September, he doubled down by saying he was not sure the election could be honest. His hedging, along with his expressed desire in June to invoke the 1807 Insurrection Act to send active duty troops onto American streets to quell protests over the killing of George Floyd, has caused deep anxiety among senior military and Defense Department officials, who insist they will do all they can to keep the armed forces out of the presidential election this November. Despite statements by Pentagon spokesman Brooke DeWalt, who said recently that the Department of Defense has no role to play in the post-election transfer of power, experts predict that Donald Trump may use the insurgency law to deploy military officers on the streets to suppress the protesters amid controversial election results. The Insurrection Act is a federal law that enables the president to deploy U.S. Federal Army personnel in special circumstances, such as the suppression of disorder and insurgency within American cities. Given that Trump and the Republican Party will not accept the result of this November's elections, there are reports that Democrats may refuse to accept the election results if Donald Trump wins. At the same time, there have been reports of renewed anti-racist protests in U.S. cities after a grand jury's decision on Wednesday, 23rd of September, not to bring charges relating to Breonna Taylor's death. The grand jury decided not to bring direct charges against three police officers: Breonna Taylor, a black female who was killed in the city of Louisville, Kentucky. In New York, anti-racism protesters blocked Brooklyn Bridge during the Breonna Taylor demonstration and demanded justice for the black woman killed by police officers. The recent events reveal America's true face, which was once a dreamland for those who look for democracy. It seems that November's presidential election will turn into a nightmare if both nominees, or even one of them, reject the results of the election. In that case, it will undermine conceptions like American Dream and Great America. The upcoming danger is not merely that the 2020 presidential election will bring political and social split. Americans fear something much worse may happen. The country is facing highly serious challenges, such as the coronavirus pandemic, a reckless leader, deep-rooted racial discrimination, and failed political system that is apt to resort to violent acts against protesters. There are enough to overthrow empires or superpowers. According to the New York Times, from Myanmar to Canada, people are asking, how did a superpower allow itself to be felled by a virus? And why won't the president commit to a peaceful transition of power? We should take warning by New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman seriously when Friedman declared recently that the United States could be headed towards a second civil war following Donald Trump's comments around not carrying out a peaceful transition of power should he lose this November's election. New York Times' Thomas Friedman said, "You know, I began my career as a journalist covering Lebanon's civil war and in its history. I'm terrified to find myself ending my journalistic career covering America's potential second civil war in its history."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي جعل الحمد مفتاحا لذكره وسببا للمزيد من رحمته ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف بريته حبيب إله العالمين أبي القاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. قال الله في كتابه الكريم أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فقال إن هذا إلا سحر يؤثر إن هذا إلا قول البشر سأصليه سقر وما أدراك ما سقر لا تبقي ولا تذر لواحة للبشر عليها 19 وما جعلنا أصحاب النار إلا ملائكة وما جعلنا عدتهم إلا فتنة للذين كفروا ليستيقن الذين أوتوا الكتاب ويزداد الذين آمنوا إيمانا ولا يرتاب الذين أوتوا الكتاب والمؤمنون وليقول الذين في قلوبهم مرض والكافرون ماذا أراد الله بهذا مثلا كذلك يضل الله من يشاء ويهدي من يشاء وما يعلم جنود ربك إلا هو وما هي إلا ذكرى للبشر. It's speaking about those who are questioning Allah, questioning what he has, what his orders, things like that. It says that this person, he went away disdainfully, saying it is nothing but magic, meaning the Quran is nothing but magic. But Allah says, soon I shall cast him into the saqar. Allah continues, he says, and what do you know what the saqar is? Who can show you what the saqar is? It neither spares nor leaves. The saqar, it burns the skin to a charcoal color. It's a reminder to all of us. It burns the skin. Now this is what we're going to deal with today, inshallah. The verse says, the verse that follows says, there are 19 keepers over this fire. 19 keepers. And then the next verse, which is the longest verse of this surah, Surah Al-Muddathir, this is the 30th verse. We have assigned only angels as keepers of the fire. And we have made their number merely a stumbling block for the faithless, and that those given the book may be reassured and the faithful may increase in faith. Until the end of the verse, where it says, those who don't have faith, they say, what did Allah mean by this description? 19? What does 19 mean? Until the end of the verse. In the beginning of the intro, you know, the Arabic lines that we always start with, we say, Habib Allah al-Alamin, to the Prophet, right? Question here, why is the Prophet Habib Allah al-Alamin? Well, there's lots of different reasons to that, of course. But we have been ordered 5 times a day in our prayers to say one of the most important, if not the only reason why he is Habib Allah al-Alamin, which is in our tashahud, of course. Wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan abduhu wa rasul. Abduhu. Everything revolves around Abduhu.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to